welcome back to the Corporate Real Estate Insider Podcast. We are here with episode 36, starting us off with a really depressing topic. Brian is going to be talking about the loneliness of the average American worker. Brian, let's hear what you got.
Well, we're going to try to solve this problem on the pod today. So it's not going to end as depressing as it starts. But an article this weekend caught my eye in the journal titled The Loneliness of the American Worker. And apparently, and I didn't know this, last year, the U.S. Surgeon General declared a loneliness health epidemic. So that started last year. But some of the stats from this that we can talk about. So more than 40% of fully remote workers polled in a 2023 survey report not leaving their house for days. This is for people who are in the office. 25% of their time is spent in virtual meetings. Only 8% of their time is in in-person meetings. Americans have tripled the amount of time spent in meetings since 2020. And the result, the number of U.S. adults who call themselves lonely has climbed to 58%, up 12 points since 2018. So it's clearly a reflection of the change in, you know, not everything's good about remote and hybrid work, right? The change in work styles is creating an epidemic in the country around people and our ability to connect with others and spend time socially. And I think, you know, honestly, I think in speaking with my clients, they're aware of this concern and they're doing a lot. And I think there's a lot to be learned and a lot to continue to change, but they're doing a lot to try to create social interactions within the office, right? So there's certain days of the week that they are trying to get everybody there in the scenarios of hybrid workers and bring everybody in and do a lot more larger meetings, a lot more social gatherings during those days, and really try to get people away from their work to try to help with this concern. And who knows, I think it's going to be a lot better in 5 years in terms of how companies respond to this. I think, right, there's a lot to be learned, but it's, I thought it was shocking to hear those stats and honestly kind of sad.
Yeah, I agree. I read the same article. And you know, let's talk about, besides the impact on culture, I wonder about the health consequences. I mean, seriously, let's think about, like, not leaving your house for days is not healthy. And I think the article, Brian, talked about how loneliness is linked to increased risks of heart disease, strokes, dementia, all sorts of awful things. So nobody's suggesting, I think, that staying at home for a few days is going to cause those things. But the point being is that this goes beyond workplace satisfaction or job satisfaction. You know, this never leaving the house, sort of, so to speak, is just, it's awful. I mean, we're meant to be around each other, even if for those of us that are introverted, maybe having some sort of interaction, I think, is still important. And work for decades, if not over a century, was part of that. And now it's gone away. And let's think about the causes of this. I mean, I encourage our listeners to think about, you know, what is driving this loneliness? And it could be poor work culture. I mean, culture is very important, not just the productivity. Are your employees engaged? There could be a severe lack of engagement amongst your peers. What about the tasks that you're assigning to them? Are they super stressful? You know, requiring deadlines that are unattainable? And then is there just a severe, you know, insufficient social interaction amongst those peers? Zoom is not a social interaction. Zoom is taxing. It's exhausting. And for friends of mine who tell me they're on like 6 to 7 Zoom calls a day, just sounds awful, and it can lead to a sense of isolation. I don't know. I think there's more to this than just simply like people being lonely, being on Zoom calls. I think there's huge impacts both in the workplace, but also extenuating from that into your own personal life. But so think about just like, I think if you're one of those companies that is full remote and you do, you know, look in the mirror and say, gosh, we're behind Zoom pretty much all day. Think about efforts to combat this loneliness and create more opportunities for the social interactions within your team, even if you're a remote workforce, maybe gathering, you know, for offsites or meetings just to reconnect with one another, hear how things are going, because you know, the circumstances that could extenuate beyond this could be pretty severe for both your teammates and the productivity of your company.
Yeah, good point. I think it adds another dimension to this. So, and this is, I think, the case at most companies. There was a stat in here around, at Microsoft, for example, in 2019, 61% of teams worked in the same location. So you work with people, you socialize with people, you want to have to work with them, you become friends, right? Because you work in the same location. That number has dropped to 27% as teams get more decentralized and workers are spread out all over the company's offices, right? So there's another layer here in that the people that you deal with professionally within your organization may not even be sitting in the same location as you, right? So how do you, you know, if you work next door to someone who's on a completely different team, you don't interact with them. For some people, including myself at times, it's like it's kind of awkward to go walk next door. It's like, hey, I'm Brian. Nice to meet you. What do you do here? You know, it's beholden on the leaders to try to, within an office, to understand this, absorb it, and create the opportunities for people that don't work together, that work at the same company, to really come together, because it's a lot harder. If you work with someone, you're in the same office, you grab them, you go to a conference room, you go to lunch after a meeting ends early, hey, let's go grab a sandwich. But if you don't work day-to-day with someone, it just becomes more challenging. And really, it's on the leaders of those offices to try to build structure, I think, around interactions.
Okay, I got something to say about this. So last Thursday, I presided over my final meeting as board chair of YMCA overnight camps. We run 3 camp properties and 30,000 camper nights a year. And so put this in the context of your kids. You would never allow it to happen. I mean, here we advocate for getting kids out of doors, overcoming nature deficit disorder. While they're at camp for a week, they leave their electronics at home. Here's a stat, and this is like 12 years old now. This is, the average child spends 7 minutes a day in some form of outdoor play and 7 hours a day in front of an electronic screen. Just brutal. So, you know, camp is so great where kids have to leave the electronics behind. Kids have to get out of doors. Kids have to interact with other human beings. Super healthy, super essential. And here's the thing, it's absolutely true for adults as well. So this idea that you're sitting in front of a computer screen all day and then you don't leave home for multiple days, that's just brutal and unhealthy and unsustainable. My goodness, I'm alarmed by those stats. Hey, by the way, you know, what are we doing to avoid that same problem? Here we're all looking at each other on a screen right now, but I'm going to see you all tomorrow gathering as a team. How cool is that? Looking forward to seeing you guys in person.
Yeah, me too. I'm really excited. So a question for all of you, right? I know we have listeners that are in charge of real estate at companies of all different sizes, but a lot of listeners in particular from those types of companies that have thousands or tens of thousands and even some with hundreds of thousands of employees. For all of us, I mean, we work in offices that have, you know, in the, you know, low dozens number of people, right? Where you know everyone, you know what their life is like, what they're into, who their friends are and everything like that. If you're at a 2,000 or 5,000 square foot or 5,000 employee headquarters location and you're walking around, the probability of you knowing anyone that you bump into in the kitchen or in the cafeteria or in the parking garage is really low. How do you create a workplace culture of introducing yourself to people, building connection, getting to know one another? And how do you think the role of the real estate director plays into that?
Tucker, that is a great question. I'm a strong believer that the role of the real estate director is evolving rapidly. I think of one particular client that kind of had this figured out ahead of time, and they've brought real estate together with their hospitality and workplace experience team. And I think the strongest people in the industry are going to do more of that. They're going to realize that real estate isn't about the location as much anymore as about the whole place, and that's inside and out. It's not about having, you know, an efficient layout like it was 10 years ago and replacing offices with cubes and opening walls up and, oh my God, we just created this great new dynamic workplace. It's around how do we create meaningful experiences for people when they do come into the office. And, you know, in this same article, they talked about, the difference between kind of large, meaningful relationships with people that you get to know really well versus just short interactions and frequency of those interactions, which are more important, they think, to your happiness, right? And they are probably more important to your productivity, because I think we have we've sacrificed our happiness for productivity, in the sense that we want to stay home, we keep claiming, okay, we're as efficient, we're as productive at home, but what is that? Does that really make us happier? We're people who need to, you know, we're a species that needs to be around people, and a lot of times you get that in your work environment. So I think being a real estate director that is able to leverage their experience with the physical real estate and bring people into it and really lean into the people side is going to be the organizations that have excellent scores when it comes time for these types of surveys.
I can't remember if I've talked about this on the pod before, but I definitely have gone down this rabbit hole because I had a great opportunity, a good fortune, to meet with Suzanne Heidelberger and learn about the work she was doing at Fidelity Investments and American Express prior to that, where she would literally conduct hospitality programs, basically take different teams at these companies through her program around hospitality. And the way she describes it is the experience of being at work should be a warm welcome and a fond farewell, and everywhere in between sprinkled with moments of delight. I think I said that right. And what she would do in these programs that she would run, it was something of the golden rule to treat other people in the way that you would like to be treated. In other words, the energy you bring to that interaction every time, it's a sort of energy up in that human interaction. And then these people would, like in the company, they would see this change in the cafeteria team or in the security team. And then suddenly the marketing team is going to her and saying, we want to go through that program as well. And it had this profound impact on the way people interacted with one another when they had these chance encounters. And people told stories about taking it back to their home and into their neighborhoods and their communities. And it kind of changed the way they would interact in these chance encounters with other people that they would run across. I thought that was super cool. I actually wrote an article on it. It's on our Hughes Myrna blog, Hospitality in the Workplace. And so, yeah, there's magic in that. Talk about, you know, lonely employees. Let's get people back together and let's have them interact in a really positive way with one another.
It's interesting when you think about the idea of how do you solve for this at a multi-thousand person location where people feel the sense of connectivity to all of the people that they work with. And John, you make a really good point that you don't actually need to solve for that. You know, of course, it would be great for everyone to be really friendly and cordial and introduce one another and all that passing in the hallway. But really what's most important is that those team members, those workers feel really close and connected to their immediate team that they spend all of their time or the majority of their time collaborating with, right? You don't actually have to have this web of connectivity across thousands of different people, which, you know, obviously, you know, you look at all the science on building relationships, it's really hard to have relationships with more than 100 people at once, right? Like that's sort of the magic number around like, when like a tribe became multiple tribes, you know, as you look back on history. If you're trying to solve for this, you just need to figure out how to make sure that those specific teams that are working together are really close.
You know, I can go deeper still. I actually, it hasn't come out yet, but I just wrote a second article with Hospitality in the Workplace Part 2, because here again, I had the great fortune to meet with a pretty remarkable team that I didn't know before. Are you all familiar with the architectural firm NBBJ? They're really crushing it. They're surprising. And anyway, they've got this clever really interesting thing they came up with called the delight factor, where they measure the score of the space. And let me quickly glance so I make sure to get it right. There are basically four elements that they measure: daylight, variety, nature, and socialization. So that Suzanne Heidelberger piece is the socialization, the interaction of the people. But then also, if you think about it, the best space is daylight, you know, access to natural light. Okay, we've always known that. Nature, you know, greenscape, green score, plants, variety of plants, and then variety, the chance encounters, different types of space, it being the opposite of, let's say, monotony. And so they can look at a space and measure it in those things, and they call it the delight factor. And I think that really resonates as true for me. The really great spaces where it feels good to be there have those four elements.
Yeah, that is interesting. I was trying to cross-reference this to another report that recently came out that was in the news in Morningstar over the weekend as well, around research around employees who can choose between on-site, remote, and hybrid work are 14 times less likely to quit and stay, quiet quit. And they were just looking at the statistics of that, between 2021 and 2023, overall reporting, employees reporting fair pay increased by 9 points between that period of time. Employees reporting work-life balance increased 13 points in that period. Employees reporting a psychologically and emotionally healthy workplace, only 2-point improvement. So you see that the data is coming at us from a lot of different directions around where where companies need to focus. And to your point, the delight factor is an interesting way for someone to try to put some metrics around the quality, right? And this particular one that came from Morningstar's reporting, they attribute massive increases in all of the factors if you have a culture of trust with your manager. They kind of report back, and I don't have the statistics in front of me specifically, but the organizations that have built the highest level of trust top-down are reporting significantly higher scores in the surveys, which is very interesting, I thought.
I just want to add one little anecdote that might be supplementary to what we've been talking about for any corporate real estate director. So I was thinking about Tucker's question, like, you know, what happens if you're a 5,000 person company, right? Walking to the parking garage or the cafeteria or to the, you know, water cooler, you know, it's going to be hard to connect with 5,000 people and, you know, otherwise focus on your team. But I was just sitting there thinking, like, okay, so amongst your team, you know, what can you be doing to enhance those relationships? And it reminded me of an article that was in the journal, I think it was Today, and it was this reporter who traveled to Tampa, Florida with Ross Rayburn. I didn't know who Ross Rayburn was, but apparently he's the lead yoga instructor and mindfulness coach on Peloton. I want to check him out now because he sounds like an interesting guy. But he talks about how he never gets stressed when he's traveling. You know, John, I think it was you that mentioned we're all going to be together tomorrow, so we're all traveling from our respective cities to San Diego. But how just acts of service can have a remarkable effect on your happiness. And if we're talking about MBBJ's delight factor, maybe your delight. And so it just got me thinking, as you guys were talking, thinking about this article I read, like maybe within your teams, if you're a huge company, you got a team of a dozen or maybe less or maybe more, promote acts of service within your corporate office, because that might significantly enhance the socialization and the happiness amongst your employees. And if you're wondering like what I'm referring to, it could be a myriad of different things. Do you have a mentorship program within your organization? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. What a great way for a senior person to get to know a junior person. Peer-to-peer recognition. We do that here at Hughes Marino. We give each other wow cards where we express our gratitude and kind of our amazement for people that go above and beyond for certain things. And we publicly recognize them amongst our peers. Volunteer opportunities. We do a ton of that here at Hughes Marino. I know a lot of other companies around the country do it, but I always find they're fun, right? We get out of the office for the day, volunteer our time with a meaningful organization, make an impact on the community. And again, there's a lot of conversations that are being had in those days that are not necessarily related to business. They're conversations that are having amongst your peers, which often turn into casual conversations. So lots of different ways to kind of go off on a tangent here, and I don't want to get too off topic, but as it relates to loneliness and, you know, building cultures within even huge companies, nobody's suggesting you're doing this amongst 5,000 people, but yeah, I think with teams, having a sense of gratitude and service could go a long way.
I think you're onto something. I think to get this back to our audience, right? What can real estate do? I think their alignment and forcing the alignment with their HR and hospitality organization is important. But I think what I've learned is that real estate can start to think about amenities within the space differently, right? So, you know, before it was, okay, do we have the cafes? Do we have fitness? Do we have, a mother's room and things that are kind of like, you know, your standards with any office space, some of them even required by building code. But as you start to think about the employees and who's going to be showing up to the office, what are some other things that interest people that you can hopefully bring people out of their cubes or offices to do? Is it music? Is it art? Is it, is it kids and summer programs and for charity? Is it stuff that is just different? Think about the office differently, and what there's got to be different categories that attract different people, and how to get, you know, people that wouldn't normally go sit in a yoga class or go to the gym or be working in the cafeteria because it's too loud. What would be interesting to them on the schedule to pull them out of their office? And, you know, I think personally, I think one of the things that shouldn't be the reason, and most companies fall into this category because it's easy, is alcohol and you know, let's have a happy hour and cocktail hour. And it just hit home to me because I was talking to a former client that is not, not in the industry anymore, who doesn't drink anymore. And he's going down to New York for some meetings, and he said, it's hell to him because at 4 o'clock at this particular company he's consulting with, at 4 o'clock, here comes the alcohol cart. Here comes everybody out of their offices and everyone starts drinking. It's a very young, it's a tech company and the culture is that. And he's like, I have to leave because this is just not the environment I want to be in. So it has, and he's not alone. I think if you look at the data, less and less people that are coming into the workforce, the younger generation, are actually drinking alcohol socially, and they're drinking it at the same clip that my generation is or older. So I think one of the things that companies should do is really rethink this and not use the crutch of happy hours and social hours and beer carts as the, you know, as the means to get people to socialize, because I think you're leaving out an increasing population of your workforce.
Okay, well, I think we did a decent job rescuing the loneliness and depressing start of that conversation and ending on a more positive note of things that we can do, things that we are doing to, you know, hopefully have teams that are thriving. So let me pivot to a new topic, and it's a topic we've talked about a lot, but it's interesting because it's happening. And let me start by giving props to Owen. We've talked a lot about like the shifting dynamics in the urban core and suburban markets and the commute and our jobs leaving the downtown city center and going into the suburbs. Our people, and then Owen made the great point, look, there's nothing like a thriving downtown. And in order to have a thriving downtown, it has to be clean, it has to be safe, and it has to have people who live downtown. It's not just a place for jobs. So there's this shifting, like in one perspective, maybe jobs are going to the suburbs away from the downtown city center. In another way, the residences, the people are moving and living in the downtown, moving from the suburbs back to the downtown. So both of those are interesting and on my mind. And so I saw this article in Bloomberg that caught my headline, Coworking is Moving to the Suburbs. And I won't read, let me give you the subtitle. With WeWork, a shell of its former self, industry leader IWG is betting that hybrid workers outside of big cities are the future. And I won't read the whole article. It does a good job telling the story of the tortoise and the hare, the hare being WeWork and the tortoise being boring, lowly Regus, which is now IWG. HQ is also under the IWG brand. For example, top U.S. co-working operators by number of locations. Number one now is Regus. Again, that is IWG with 957 sites. Number two is HQ, also IWG, with another 190 sites. Number three is WeWork with 172. Like, that's just wild. What once was WeWork is in a distant third. And that lowly little tortoise, Regus and HQ and IWG are the leaders of the pack now. Crazy. Okay, but here's what it says. I'm reading one paragraph. This is a quote. Thousands are changing their working habits, shifting from daily trips to crowded distant city centers to working primarily in the commuter towns they call home, with only occasional visits to city center offices. IWG founder and CEO Mark Dixon wrote in the foreword to a new report on, quote, the commuter town boom, prepared by his company and the engineering and design firm Arup Group. In some areas, the increase could be as high as 175%, which will require a substantial increase in the amount of high-quality office space available in towns that have previously had relatively low numbers of locally based white-collar workers. So IWG thinks the jobs are going to the suburbs. And I think there's real merit to that reasoning. You know, the commute, the dreaded commute, if it can be avoided, I think people lean into that. And then just a quick counterpoint. Here's another article. I won't do the whole thing because it's a CoStar article that titled Detroit Struggles to Expand Revitalization Outside Booming Downtown. And it does this great job of telling the story of Detroit, which has seen radical, successful redevelopment of its downtown urban core and virtually none in its suburbs, which are, you know, vacant land. They tore down the old decrepit buildings and now it's just vacant land. And there's a whole other story going there. But I bring that up to make the point that I think there is no single answer. Every market's going to have its nuance and its subtleties and going to be different. I do think there's this merit to the idea that that IWG is pointing to, that you know, they're going to open much of their expansion now is in these suburban office markets where they think people want to, if they need to pull into an office, they'd rather do it and avoid the commute. But we'll see across the board, suburbs or downtowns or both. What do you think?
I think there's a lot to unpack here. I think much like the brokerage community where, you know, there was rapid growth in the number of brokers and every firm can support very inexperienced young people that continue to just think that the business is, you know, finding space and doing leases with very little strategy, which is, you know, has thinned out and there's a lot less people in the industry. I think there's going to be a lot less players, as we've seen with WeWork's demise in the co-working space. I think if you name, so if you remember back HQ, I think you named them as one, they went bankrupt and were bought out of bankruptcy by Regus. Regus itself went bankrupt. I'm not sure if it's once or multiple times. WeWork's gone bankrupt. I think the model in itself is very difficult because you're giving companies the flexibility to respond to changes in market cycle without long-term commitments. But underlying that is long-term lease commitments that are very expensive, that are not flexible with changing market environments. So the whole concept of co-working and this temporary space to meet demand is, unless there's a shift in how companies use it, like some of my clients that are using it to open offices rather than spend the capital investment. But at the same time, if that office doesn't meet certain criteria, they'll probably pull back and be able to exit the market as well. They certainly will. And I just think the model's broken. I think that the experience that people are going to be getting at these, and this is a broad brush, but the experience employees are going to get at these centers, unless the companies make an investment themselves in the space, is probably not going to meet long-term goals for what they're trying to solve. So for, you know, for a certain classification of the market, it's great. But I think overall, put them in downtown, put them in the suburbs. In the short term, it's going to lead to people just not using it. I'm not a huge believer that co-working long-term is a solution for anything other than small increments for companies to, you know, either move into new markets or to grow very rapidly as they're changing their strategy.
Brian, you're kind of the Debbie Downer today, man. But you sort of make a mixed argument. On the one hand, I thought what you were getting at is that the building owners are crazy to lease to these folks because in the downturn, they quickly lose their tenant base. They quickly lose their ability to pay their rent, and they're subject to bankruptcy. You have all these examples where in the downturns, they go bankrupt. So why do the landlords lease to them, period? That's one argument, sort of negative as it relates to the co-working operators. I'm not sure I agree with you on the, I think they serve a role. I think they're, if they can convince a landlord to let them lease space in their building and overcome this risk of a bankruptcy and the next sudden downturn in the office market, I think they provide a really great role for young growing companies that just want to make a quick commitment, come together, you know, and don't have to go and sign a 3 or 5 year lease and manage a whole build out and move into space. They provide tremendous flexibility. So from the user perspective, I think they are a good little part of the market, important part of the market.
I'm not going to disagree. I think the first part of it, owners do the deals because you've got to look at the motivation of those owners. They're not, a lot of them don't even own their buildings other than a small sliver. Secondly, they're all collecting fees, transaction fees, asset management fees, property management fees. Others have hold periods that, you know, you do a 15-year lease with a co-working tenant that pays rent for a year or two, and then you flip out of it, and it's not your problem anymore. And I think the marketplace is a lot worse off today from an investment perspective for owners than it was a few years ago because of the decisions they've made, but also just the health of the industry in general. And I think the market's going to be a lot smarter on the other side of this as, you know, as co-working tries to rebound. Because I just remember a deal that was done here. WeWork went and signed, and I won't name the building, but it was like an $80 gross deal, 15 years with 150 in work, right? And they never occupied half of the space, never built it out. Took all the capital, put it into the other floors. So now the building's coming back to the landlord with some shell spaces, which they, on their books, have put $150 a foot into, right? So it just never penciled out and never worked. And whoever the investors are in that building, a lot of them public investors, public pension funds, you know, it's owned in a lot of ways by investors or by debt, are the ones that are holding that building now. And the landlord that you dealt with owned a very small portion of the building, and they've moved on and they're, you know, are likely moving on, and they're going to go try to do it again with another building somewhere. So I think the marketplace is going to get a lot smarter about it. So it's just really hard to make it work. I think the experience is good for a very small portion of the market. The companies you're talking about, John, absolutely. Do they need to be the largest tenant in New York City at some point? No, because it's not the largest segment of the tenant base in New York City, right? It's the way they were creating demand is by catering to the large corporates that are buying into it because of the flexibility to be able to make very little investment and pull out in a downturn. And it just doesn't align. And I think the large companies that use it appropriately and take advantage of it is great. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And I think that'll continue, but it still isn't a big enough segment of the market to, to keep the Regis's, the WeWorks, and all these firms at the same scale as they are today, in my opinion.
I think the point here around what's the motivation of these landlords is really good. And a lot of times when you see real estate transactions that happen that have, say, an insane amount of capital or is a really high credit risk to the landlord, or there's some nuanced thing around the deal that the industry is kind of sitting there being like, wait a minute, how does that deal make any sense? A lot of times it just doesn't make sense, right? And it, particularly if you think about what's the right thing for the building in the long term. And you know, the point that we've made on the podcast now across many episodes that these buildings are owned in weird ways And when the owner doesn't actually have meaningful skin in the game in the form of equity in the building, then it's really hard to think about how they're making decisions in a rational way, because oftentimes they're not making decisions in a rational way. There's this moral hazard of, if we buy the deal, we get to charge a 2% acquisition fee. If we own the deal, we get to charge a 5% property management fee. If we do a lease in the building that might not even make economic sense in the long run, then we get to pay ourselves a leasing commission. And you just think about real estate investment as really this vehicle for real estate syndicators to charge fees to the actual equity, the actual owner of the building. It's a pretty gross setup. And look, some people do it incredibly well and they're great stewards of their investors' capital. And then there's other people that are just running an asset management business and trying to make as much money as they can. And unfortunately, that is usually at the expense of these pension funds and life insurance companies. And you think about whose money is actually that, and it's the pensioners and the people that are making investments into life insurance policies and all that. So it's I think it's pretty messed up, pretty wrong, and that there should be a much better alignment of incentives.
Yeah, I was, it's funny, you just rung a memory in my mind. I was with a director of real estate, and he's a listener of the pod, so what up? And I just remember him back on the conversation, and his, he works as a director of real estate for a company that leases a lot of space around the world. They also own some of their real estate. And he's tasked with leasing the owned real estate that they don't occupy. And the it struck me very differently how intensely passionate he was about it and doing in being able to bring really high quality retail tenants and high quality tenants to the owned assets. But how different the approach is, and just on what's important. Obviously, it's getting the most rent and getting the highest rent. But just in a brief conversation, it was just, they talk a different language. And if I was in that market and I had met with this particular building and owner, you'd sense it, you'd feel it. It's just a different conversation. It's different level of attention to the building and what's important. It's a different level of amenities and infrastructure and a lot of things that you can't provide a building if you're looking at it on paper as a, you know, as an investment firm doing this as an investment. You want to reduce your capital as much to get as much return as you can for your investors. And this building was built for a different reason. I get it. But just the way that the messaging that the marketplace was getting, I guarantee from this particular person on what's important, reflected in why the building is fully leased. Put it that way. So there's a solution out there and people will recognize it, I believe.
This is a issue that has been around for a long time, right? Like the principal agent issue. And in many ways, it exists in like corporate real estate advisory and brokerage, right? A lot of times the best brokers can also be the busiest brokers. And over time, if you're, you know, excellent at what you do and you're sought after and people are reaching out to you, you're going to have more business than you can possibly do. And then if you're in that position, then probably there's some erosion in terms of the level of quality that you're providing. And the same thing is true in venture capital and private equity firm, private equity. I mean, you've seen, you know, a fund goes from managing $100 million to managing $1 billion, and all of a sudden their returns suck. Well, guess what? Even though the returns aren't very good, the venture firm or private equity firm is making way more money because they're charging fees on, you know, 10x the amount of capital. And in all of these industries, I think what it really comes down to is working with people that really care, that are really committed, that are willing to make less money in the pursuit of being excellent at their craft. And if you're a real estate investor, being excellent at your craft, I would argue more than anything, is getting great returns for your investors, because that's why people are investing. If you're a corporate real estate advisor working with big companies, helping them, you know, negotiate these different transactions and optimize their portfolio, more so than anything, your ability to call yourself elite at what you do comes down to the results that you're getting your clients. And I think you consistently see the top performers in all of these spaces, whether it be brokers, advisors, or if it is investors or whomever, it's really a focus on how do we serve our clients? How do we do a great job for our client? How do we create the best outcomes for the work that we're actually being hired to do? Instead of putting yourself first and trying to figure out how you make as much money as you can in this model where the incentives aren't aligned. So even if there isn't necessarily incentive alignment, you can still have great fiduciary representation, both on the asset management side, the brokerage side, and any other industry where this exists. And I think in the long run, ultimately, we'll see these investors for fees that are doing it in an unethical manner probably not exist anymore. At least, hopefully, the market will recognize what they're doing and they will, over some period of time, cease to exist.
Yeah, or just, you know, they can do it. They can do it ethically too, right? You can do it. You can tell everyone what your fees are. You can have this great pro forma expectation on the returns, and everyone, you know, look at Elon Musk's, what is it, like $25 or $50 billion pay package. I mean, there's many people that believe that's way too high. There's others that believe it's appropriate based on the value he created. Hopefully, these firms, I think, are articulating appropriately the disclosures around what they're charging and how they charge. And if they're making everybody money, people just look the other way. I think what we will see is that these firms are just not aligned with their clients, and they're not putting their clients first. They're putting their investors first. And if you put your clients first, your investors will make a lot of money. I think same in our business. So if you put your clients first, and always put your clients first, everything else will take care of itself. And I think the landlords that put their clients first and do the right thing by their clients and provide the highest level of service are going to be the ones that win in this type of an environment.
You know, at the risk of self-promotion, I'm going to mention our core values. Tucker, hearing you describe it the way you did, I just went right there in my mind. And just this idea of like how great to work for a company, you know, where the first core value is always do the right thing, which is exactly what you're describing. Second core value, deliver excellence in everything we do. I think there's not a lot of wiggle room in that. That's a pretty high bar. Or build lasting relationships based on trust. So yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know. We talk about them a lot, but that's only because they matter and because we mean it. But it's fun to hear you talking about them that way, Tucker.
What about me, John?
Oh,
you didn't like what I said? Come on. That you're telling Owen he did great in the last pod. You're telling Tucker he made a great point. I'm over here, you know, doing my best, John. I'm doing my best.
I love you like a brother. We're going to spend some time together in the coming days, and we'll be sure to tighten things up.
I know you take this stuff very personally. I'm just kidding. I know you, Tucker, deserve the credit right there. That was just a joke. Don't take it personal.
Owen took us to the love languages. He's talking about gifts of service. Apparently, you like praise, and I'll duly noted. I'll be sure to share more praise with you in the future, Brian.
Yeah, I do. Who doesn't like to be praised, you know? Like, can I change gears?
Before you do, I want to say something about suburbia and co-working, because I didn't feel like jumping in when Tucker was giving us his feedback, which I thought was fantastic, and it went a little bit off topic. So I want to bring it back. One last point. So we talked about co-working in the suburban markets. Back to the previous part of this pod, or the first part of this pod, about loneliness and so forth, I have clients that are leasing co-working space in suburbia for one or two people at most. And sometimes it's because that person isn't afforded a place at home to work. Maybe they're in an apartment and they've got a spouse that works at home. Maybe they got little kids. I get that certainly is a unique circumstance and one that needs to be addressed. But if you're simply getting your coworker a co-working space for the sake of having one, right? Is that really solving anything? Because I would suggest it's not. If you walk to any co-working space these days, it's all private offices for the most part around the window line, very little communal space in the interior. And it's kind of lonely too, right? You shut the door, you don't really see people, and the people you do see are working at different companies, not your own company, so you have less incentive to even meet these people. And so this notion that the co-working spaces are moving out to suburbia to attract these people that don't want to drive into downtowns, you know, I'm not a huge believer that they're going to have a tremendous amount of success for a couple of reasons. Number one, usually there's a lack of amenities in suburbia relative to downtown. And two, if you're only trying to solve for the onesie, twosie type of occupancy, what's the point? And I think there'll when it comes time to start really cutting costs, if we ever end up in sort of a pullback in the economy where companies are looking to shed expense, what's easy to shed first? Co-working. They're usually month-to-month leases. At most, they're a year. So I'm not betting long on co-working succeeding tremendously in suburban markets. But that's just, call me a contrarian.
You know where I think co-working is going to vastly exceed everyone's expectations? Inside a data center. Data center co-working is here to stay. And it's going to explode for some reasons we talked to on other podcasts. I'm working on one right now, the colo of a particular client within a larger data center. And just how you can leverage all of the infrastructure that's put in there by the data center operator and not have to spend the CapEx to do it yourself is I think, continuing to expand exponentially. The topic I did want to transition to, though, was also a market that was expanding exponentially and is not so much anymore around industrial. So I saw some stats that came out just to set the table. Two billion square feet added in the industrial market across the country in the last 4 years. Just a massive, massive number. But year over year, this year, construction starts are off almost 50%. So the pace of expansion is slowing drastically. And it's expected, right? But bringing it down to the local level, we're seeing the amount of vacancy, at least here in the Northeast, to be significantly higher. Lease up assumptions on buildings is, you know, double, triple what investors and what landlords were expecting. And we're just seeing companies, you know, that were expecting to grow and take down more space, waiting, holding back, not necessarily figuring it out. You know, others using 3PLs under short-term contract, the co-working of the, you know, the industrial industry in many ways. And it's just interesting because the growth was so dramatic and the slowdown is coming, I think, equally as dramatic. And there's a lot less, I think, reporting on it right now because the data is still new and it's still coming out. But I think there's, you know, data trickling out around this particular topic that's very interesting.
But it's, I think that market's behaving like a good old traditional cycle where, yes, there was profound demand increase through the pandemic for industrial. And what do? Builders build buildings. You know, in the face of dramatic rising demand, they bought land, planned buildings, and got underway on construction and delivering, you know, that 2 billion square feet of industrial real estate. And of course, Michael, cycles turn, and we've sort of got off that cotton candy high of the pandemic industrial, you know, demand, and things slow down. And there's a time lag because the stuff that's already under construction, you're not going to stop that. The stuff that you're in for permits, maybe you go forward with those too. So there's a time lag from when the industrial demand started to wane to when the builders stopped building, and we're into that phase now. And how far down the cycle goes, we don't know. But this is just a good old-fashioned, it's a little different from office space where we had sort of a societal change in response to remote and hybrid working. This is just industrial demand and excess inventory in response to the builders building buildings because they saw so much demand.
It's interesting to say that this is less of a societal change than office space, which I agree with, but I think it's a little bit more complicated. Right, because the run-up in industrial pricing was really caused by a temporary societal change, just like how office space has been, you know, now permanently, we all believe, permanently damaged as a result of, you know, revised work-from-home policies that are probably here to stay even, you know, 10, 20, 30 years from now. I think when you actually look at a chart of what's happened to industrial rents on a national basis and I guess I can talk more like regionally specific to Southern California. The rents are nowhere, even though they're starting to come down, they're nowhere near where they were in 2018 or 2019. I mean, they're still, you know, 40, 50% higher than what they were, depending on, you know, which market and what type of product and all that. So really, there was this societal change that happened in 2020, 2021, with this shift to e-commerce and consumer spending habits and all that, that caused this massive run-up in industrial real estate. So when people say, hey, you know, this is normal cycle, the market's going to soften. You know, in Southern California, about 20% of all available space is sublease space, and that's, you know, usually 25 to 40% less expensive than direct space. Vacancy has pretty much doubled in most of these Southern California industrial markets. Yet, when you actually look at how asking rates have fallen, they've only fallen between like 5 and 7%, depending on which market you're talking about. So when you think about statistics like that, the reality is that the market's fallen by over 20%, but nobody's talking about it. Like, I know this in reality from doing deals in real time, but it is possible that we're going to see much more dramatic pullbacks than what one might ordinarily think. And that's because you could argue that we're at these very unusual, elevated, sort of once in a generation type of rapid rent increases that were caused by societal change. And now this societal change isn't here in the same way that it is for office. And maybe the market equilibrium is much lower than what people realize it is.
But the difference I was trying to point to is the idea that as this cycle evolves, we're not going to have a significant portion of the industrial inventory rendered obsolete, like we're seeing in the office market. So
yeah,
that's the difference. You know, we'll have excess inventory, and the market will come back, and the deals will get better, and the buildings get leased up. Eventually, we'll be back into another boom, and the builders shall start building again. I just mean it's a traditional up and down cycle without the profound change that has happened in the office space.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really good clarification. We're totally on the same page here, right? Is there's structurally some very big difference between industrial and office. It is important to note that we had this. Developers are so optimistic about the future. I mean, how else could you spend all of this money building these buildings on a speculative basis, hoping that there's going to be a tenant to lease it up? If there's no tenant to lease it up, then you've probably just lost a lot of money, or as we were talking about earlier, maybe your investor's money. But I mean, it takes a special person to be optimistic about, you know, a multi-year development cycle and this binary event. You either lease it or you don't lease it. But when you do think about what happened, I mean, there was basically this belief that this surge in demand was going to continue forever. And it's so obvious that it wasn't going to continue forever. And now we have, you know, 2 billion square feet of industrial real estate that was delivered in the last couple of years, which, to put that in perspective, that's more industrial real estate than all of the industrial real estate in Orange County, Los Angeles, and the Inland Empire combined, right? Like, that's a lot of space that was delivered. And there's more space that's under construction. And now companies have leased more space than they need. And now 20% of the availability in Southern California is sublease space, right? So you just start thinking about all of these factors coming together. And it was, you know, hindsight's 2020. And the current market data suggesting that asking rates are, like, CoStar came out with a report a few weeks ago that asking rates in Southern California are down in like the mid single digit percent. The reality is that that might be statistically what it says, but actual rental rates from the peak in certain areas of Southern California are already down 40%. Yet a lot of owners bought buildings at these crazy inflated prices, both with the expectation that rents were going to continue to grow and also with the expectation that interest rates weren't going to increase dramatically.
I've been doing this for nearly 20 years, this being commercial real estate and representing tenants, and I give you two words that kind of talk about what's going on and what kind of what you're talking about. It's inertia and lag. And real estate markets, whether you're Southern California, you're here in Washington, or you're elsewhere on the East Coast, often exhibit inertia and lag due to the slow nature of transactions and how long they take to come together sometimes. And so I've found, and you can look back 25 years at charts looking at both asking rates and vacancy, and changes in vacancy rates and market conditions take time to be reflected in the asking rents as landlords, you know, gradually adjust their rents due to new realities. And so it's funny, you know, you see availability spike and you're like scratching your head going, why aren't rates now 20, 30, 40% cheaper immediately? Why isn't that like, you know, it's not as fluid as a stock market per se. And it's, the reality is that landlords are just sometimes slow to adjust to the new reality. And that behooves the representative who's serving the tenant the need to explore all the options and do what we do best, which is bring reality to fruition and negotiate the terms that we think are just. But yeah, it's crazy. I mean, you'll see lags sometimes as much as 12 to 18 months in the office market, and sometimes so in the industrial market. But no rhyme or reason, but you can see it empirically going back 30 years looking at charts.
Yeah, I think, Tucker, you hit the nail on the head with the comment of market equilibrium is probably lower, to paraphrase, lower than we think. And I think you're dead on. I think as, you know, as we saw more and more analysts covering the industrial sector, as we saw more and more large REITs or other large investment vehicles pivot to industrial real estate, there was just way more equity and capital poured into the industry, which created this building boom. With all this, you know, underlying expectations and analyst coverage around, you know, the American workers shifting to this online marketplace and working from home creates all this additional online demand. It does. But at the end of the day, if you are a manufacturer or someone who uses warehouses, if your product sits in a warehouse, you lose money. You have to continue to move it quickly. So I think they're innovating on how to reduce the cost of that that process, that cycle of getting it off the boat and into people's hands, or manufacturing it and getting it into people's hands, which in itself will have profound impacts on the overall demand of the market, right? So the industry is shifting with it, and there's just way too much capital flowing into it. And it's going to create opportunities for our clients to capitalize. And I think working with your advisors to make sure you're understanding these trends, so you're not focusing on the comps that are in your market and this little micro market phenomenon or competitiveness of a particular micro market. Pick your head up, look around, and there's probably real opportunity out there for you.
That was really smart, Brian, and really well said. And you're looking sharp. You're looking really good today.
Thank you, John. I appreciate you noticing.
Pricing is very sticky and takes landlords a long time to adjust to the new reality. And I expect that we're going to continue to see rents come down, but maybe, unfortunately, more slowly than they should in reality. Great discussion today. Episode had everything from, you know, Brian being depressed about the loneliness of the average American worker to some John Jarvis giving out compliments left and right today. Gassing up Brian at the end. Love to see that. Thanks everyone so much for listening, and we'll be back with the next episode soon.